Session number 11191, Real One.
Pearman, Real One. And if I could ask you, first of all, Lynn, about your background before World War II, you know, if you could tell me something about your life and where you were brought up and educated.
Well, I was living before the war in a place called Solihull, which is near the town of Birmingham. And at that time, I was employed by the Unilever company as a salesman in the selling of Knight's Castile toilet soap and Zixt and things like that. And one day in May 1937, I called on a particular friend of mine who was a chemist, and he had a shop very near Anstey Aerodrome. This was in April 1937, and he and I used to have lunch every day at the back of the chemist's shop. He cooked steaks for both of us. We went out of curiosity to visit the local aerodrome, which he had heard about, was offering free flying training to young men of under 25. So we both went there, and we interviewed a flight sergeant at Anstey Aerodrome who explained the idea that had then been formed of establishing a reserve of pilots called the RAF Volunteer Reserve. We both applied on the spot because we could see these lovely Avro cadets flying about in the sky, practicing circuits and bumps, and we thought how marvellous it would be to learn how to fly one of these for free. We got through the interview with the flight sergeant, and after a day or two we were asked to go again for a medical examination. Unfortunately, my friend the chemist failed his examination. He was 24, the same age as I was, and he failed, and I passed. So they then submitted me and several others to interviews by three senior RAF officers who decided at this interview whether or not we were suitable to be trained as pilots. Seven out of ten passed, I should think, after having passed the medical. And we then embarked on the program of training. We had to do a certain number of hours every year of flying training and attend three nights a week at Birmingham University to study ground subjects, navigation, engines, air rigging and so on. And we had a very pleasant time. It was rather a superior kind of club that we belonged to, flying at weekends, 2 weeks every year, 15 days consecutive flying training. And by the time the war broke out, we were all sergeant pilots, and in September the 3rd, 1939, I had obtained my flying wings that year, so I was completely qualified to go straight onto a squadron. In fact, there were several of us who had got our wings, and we were posted to initial training wings until they knew what to do with us. I went to Hastings. And then from there to Hullavington, which is a flying training school. So in spite of having been qualified, we still went through the full training before we really got onto operations.
Before we go on to your war experience, when you applied for this in 1937, I think, Did you have any idea then that there was a war brewing up?
No. I had before 1937, in my early, rather similar to June's experience, in my early 20s, I had joined the Peace Pledge Union, which was led by Dick Shepherd. And I was a sincere 22-year-old, 23-year-old pacifist. Came this opportunity to fly, those thoughts didn't enter my head. I thought the opportunity to learn to fly was so great that it... And I was becoming a little frightened by Hitler at that, again, and listening to Churchill and people like that, I was becoming persuaded that it might not be the right thing to be pacifist in the face of the menace of Nazism. Such as I had at that time, and such ideas that I had at that time, which were rather woolly, and I can't say that it was a sincere intellectual conviction, the pacifist idea. And of course, as the war unfolded, the pacifist idea completely evaporated.
The RAF was being greatly expanded.
Oh, yes.
At that time.
Oh yes, without noise and publicity, the RAF was being expanded very seriously from 1937 onwards, and May 1937 saw the launch of the RAF Volunteer Reserve. I was one of the first dozen, I understood, to join the RAF Volunteer Reserve in May 1937. And of course it grew and grew. Later on, before the war broke out, I was moved several times to other aerodromes, Castle Bromwich, north of Birmingham, Hatfield, north of London, because my job moved me down to London. Unilever moved me down to London. And then to White Waltham, which was near Ashford, Middlesex, where I was living with my then wife and two children. And came the day, September the 3rd, when I had to put on my sergeant's uniform and report to Store Street in London, where dozens of us went on that day, full of the joys, not knowing what was in front of us.
So what was your war experience then, Len, you know, before you were downed over Europe?
Yeah, well, Hull Avington was a flying training school, and we went there from the IT, initial training wing at Hastings. We took the full course of the flying training school, which was on Anson's and Hawker Hearts, and the continuation of the lectures. I had to take the wings examination all over again, which was an indication of the thoroughness of the care that the RAF did in their training. It was always terribly impressive to me. And then after Hull Avington, which took about 6 months, I was posted to Upper Hayford, near Oxford, which was an operational training unit for Bomber Command. And in this station, which was a very good one, I was trained on Hampden's bombers. And we did some operational sorties, as they called it, from Upper Hayford, over the Channel Islands, and along the Dutch coast, and elementary things like that. Some were dropping, some were used on nickel raids, which was really dropping leaflets all over the Channel Islands to keep their spirits up. And dear, this lasted, from memory, I could do better than that. I've got my logbook here. We I think I'll talk about it in general.
Yes, I think that's better, really. Yes. We can fit the dates in.
Upper Hayford was a very, very busy place. And I had the good fortune to be graded as above average as a pilot. And after the course was completed, they screened me and one or two others because they needed people who could instruct others in the flying of Hamdens, which was a very tricky aircraft to fly because we had no dual control. The pilot sat at the top in a very narrow fuselage, with the navigator in the glass nose and the top rear gunner and the bottom rear gunner at the back. The fuselage of the Hamden was so narrow that there was no room for dual control. You had to take the pupil behind you, standing behind you, and you had already given him an intense ground drill on cockpit drill, and he had to tell you exactly what to do. It was almost a primitive form of training, but it worked. And until you did this circuit after circuit and cross-country after cross-country trip, until you were convinced that the pupil understood verbally exactly what he had to do. And then came the great day when you put him in the cockpit, in the pilot seat, and he didn't have any crew or anything. He went off and did a circuit on his own. And it worked. We managed to do that. I was kept back there for practically the whole of 1940, beginning of 41. And then they posted me to daylight operations on Blenheims, and they were preparing for the mosquito, the advent of the mosquito, towards the end, middle of 41. So, for a time, I was at a place called Upwood, and a satellite aerodrome called Warboys in Huntingdonshire, where we flew Blenheims, long nose and short nose Blenheims, and one or two other types which I've forgotten, but mainly Blenheims. And then we were posted at the end of 41, or about September time in 41, to 105 Squadron at Horsham St. Faith in Lincolnshire, which is about 8 miles north of Norwich. And there were the first mosquitoes to be delivered by de Havilland to the RAF. I think one or two had been used on photograph reconnaissance unit work, but we were the first squadron to receive them. And they wanted people who had by this time a reasonable amount of experience in flying aircraft.
How did the Battle of Britain affect you?
Not at all. We were bomber command. We heard about it as the civilians did. It was nothing to do with us.
Did you feel at all involved with that, the drama of it?
We were, yes, we were most concerned with it, but not in a practical way. We had no connection, practically.
Did you have any opinion of the sort of strategy and tactics of the Battle of Britain, you know, Lord Dowding's role?
Not at this time. Not at this time. We were so busy with our own problems, our own training problems, our own operational problems, that we had no real conviction one way or the other about the Battle of Britain. But I've just finished reading a book called Right of the Line, written by John Terrain. And I am appalled by the terrible controversies that were being conducted at the top of Fighter Command by Dowding and Park, and particularly Bader, who later I got to know rather well in prison camp and lived with us. I've become terribly sorry for Dowding, who was most underrated. I can only agree with John Terrain that an injustice seems to have been done to Dowding, because he was responsible, no doubt about it, for me, for the victory of the Battle of Britain. And had he listened to people like Bader, we would have dissipated our resources and probably have had a much more difficult time with the Germans during the Battle of Britain. Thank heavens Dowding prevailed. Anyway, that's by the way. At the time when I was so busy in the RAF, I had no knowledge now at the. No knowledge of all this terrible uncertainty. So came something like September, October time. We had 12 mosquitoes and I think about a dozen Blenheims on the squadron, and we were getting to know how to use the mosquito strategically. Operating up the Dutch coast, not doing anything very serious, finding out the capacity of the aircraft. We were trying to make sure that we knew how to use it properly. It was a wonderful aircraft with a ground speed of 418 miles an hour, which was faster than anything on Earth in the air then. We had 12 miles an hour advantage over the Fokker Wolf 190 by stripping it of cannons and doing one or two things which increased the efficiency of the slipstream. We found that we could reach these speeds over the ground at 418 miles an hour. So we had a tremendous advantage, providing we didn't use cannons. If we used cannons, we lost 15 miles an hour, which just brought the Fokker Wolf 190 into a dangerous speed comparison. If the Fokker Wolf 190 had an advantage in height with its impetus, it could probably catch us for a short time, but after that we'd leave everything behind. We didn't do any serious operational flying until the first 1,000 raid on Cologne, which was on May the 30th, 1942. If you'll stop there a moment. 1942 was the first 1,000 raid on Germany, which was conducted, of course, by Bomber Command. And our squadron was given the task of trying to find out what damage had been done. It was very important for Bomber Command to discover the effect of this enormous raid on Cologne. And we began sending aircraft over, mosquitoes, over Cologne about 8 o'clock, I think, the first one went, and didn't come back. And then the second one went about 10 o'clock and came back and said that the smoke was up to 20,000 feet, and it was quite impossible to get any kind of evidence of what had been done. There were still fires raging. And we let it go for, I think, about 2 hours, and then sent another one, which didn't come back. And I went over, I think another one was sent after that one, which came back with the same degree. Squadron Leader Channer went at ground level. He went at 0 feet all the way to Cologne and back, and came back and said it was, and said there was very little he could photograph. And then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I went, and it was a beautiful summer day. And we carried 400 or 500 pound bombs and the full camera equipment to photograph, and we were asked to fly at rated altitude over the target at 23,000 feet. We crossed over the Dutch coast and stayed on course fairly consistently at 23,000 feet with no sign of fighters. We saw a few parachutes descending just after we crossed the Dutch coast, but we couldn't see any threat from fighters, and we had a fairly peaceful entrance into Germany. We crossed over the Rhine about 40 miles south of Cologne, and we could see on our port the smoke rising from the town. We saw vapor trails in the distance north of Cologne, it seemed, probably over Cologne at that time. Vapor trails, and I think that might have been another mosquito from us, from our 105 squadron. Two of us were sent at 4 o'clock, I remember now. And we continued over the Rhine. When we reached about 20 miles east of the Rhine, we turned on to 270 degrees about and came over the middle of the town with the bomb doors open and the cameras working. And we were unopposed. Do you get this sometimes?
Yes.
That's what we were doing. It was murder, of course.
Did you think that at the time?
Yes. I often did. Anyway. We continued over the town, and the cameras were working full tilt, and we dropped the bomb load right across the centre of the town. And up to that time, we had no opposition whatever. As soon as the bombs began to explode, and my navigator was lying in the nose watching the effect, the flak came up, and they seemed to have difficulty in finding our range and speed, our height and speed. But there was a heavy flak cloud on the starboard quarter, and nowhere near us. And I put the nose down slightly to increase our speed, and I think I turned about 20 degrees south to try to spoil the prediction of the anti-aircraft people. After we'd gone about another 10 or 20 seconds, another cloud of flak came up, some of it fairly close now. And suddenly the starboard engine was put out of action, in fact began to drop off, and the port wing was very badly hit. A huge gaping hole appeared in the port wing, and we were set alight. So I had to tell my navigator to bail out. And his hatch is just in the middle of the cockpit, in front of his feet. And he jettisoned the hatch and began to put himself out. He clipped his parachute on and began to put his legs through the hatch. He found, and this is a terrible thing that we must confess, that we had not practiced bailing out. We thought ourselves so clever that we didn't have to practice bailing out. So Richard, who is still alive, Richard put his legs out of the hatch and wedged himself in the hatch because his legs were taken underneath the fuselage with the slipstream that was remaining. And he was immovable. He said, I can't get out, I can't move. And by this time, it's getting rather urgent to get out. It's getting very hot. And I caught hold of his neck, so his harness, I think, on his neck, and pulled with all my might, and with his exertions we managed to get him out again. And he turned round with his facing aft and hung on to the bottom of the aircraft and then disappeared. He'd gone. Then I had to do the same. But I was sitting on my parachute, so I was able to get out rather more easily. But I did begin to make the mistake of facing forward while I was getting out, holding on to the spectacles, trying to keep whatever control I had over the aircraft. But if I remembered in time and then found myself hanging underneath and bailed out. And what beautiful peace it was. It was so quiet. We'd travelled a considerable distance from Cologne by now, most losing height. My navigator, Richard, got out at about 12,000 feet, I think, and I was able to get out at about 6,000 feet. We were in quite a helpless flat spin by now. And my parachute opened and I waited to reach the ground. All was well, it seemed. And then an aircraft began to come towards me and I thought it was a German who was going to finish me off. In fact, it was the aircraft that I just left and which was pouring smoke anyway and well alight. And it continued. It missed me by about 100 yards. I was very glad to see it. And then it disappeared, went down, and blew itself up in a farmhouse. And I continued my descent and landed eventually in a ploughed field where about 15 to 20 Hitlerjugend were waiting for me. They'd been watching my descent.